All right. Let's think about Leviticus 14 together. And the context is that the effects of sin have so alienated sinners from God spiritually that the book of Leviticus contains symbolism to communicate how separate we really are. Things that you might call ritual contamination. God is dwelling in the camp of Israel. You can see a model of this tabernacle where Israelites can enter the entrance of this courtyard unless they become ritually unclean. And in chapters 11 through 15, we see in our outline that we've been progressing through that in chapters 11 to 15 of Leviticus, there are various ways Israelites can become unclean. Last week we saw that there are skin diseases that communicate uncleanness and that you have to live outside the camp of Israel if a priest confirms that you're unclean. Throughout these chapters, we've been examining various ways of being ritually unclean. And you could be unclean for hours, days, weeks, months, or years, depending on the person's defilement. The tabernacle, this tent of meeting where you have the Israelites around it, this tabernacle is ground zero of holiness. This is the place that if you approach the Lord, you have to be considered ritually clean. You should not have been defiled outwardly by some kind of contact or disease. And Leviticus 14 touches more on that tonight. These were rules, these were instructions that communicated that there's brokenness in the world and alienation between image bearers and the God who has made them. And therefore, when we are restored to ritual cleanness in these Israelite texts, these Israelites, I say we as if we're the Israelites, but when these Israelites are restored to ritual cleanness, it's as if God is bringing them near to Him. He is holy, and their defilement is being covered or dealt with. Now, in Leviticus 13 last week, we studied how you can develop a skin condition that would render you temporarily unclean. Your translation might say something like leprosy. It was probably not full-blown leprosy in every case, but various skin disorders. The word is actually very flexible and is not limited to what we know as Hansen's disease. So that when Jesus cleansed lepers, it may have been on a spectrum broadly speaking to something more than just Hansen's disease that we think of as leprosy in our day. In Leviticus 13, though, it was very grim. You see a list of possible cases and diseases that leave you outside the camp. You could not dwell amidst the camp of Israel, nor approach the tabernacle, this tent of meeting, for worship and sacrifice. You had to live outside the camp until you were clean. That's very disconcerting. The priests had to identify you as such and pronounce you unclean. The difficulty is the priests are not physicians. They don't have like a remedy to fix whatever has rendered you unclean. You just have to wait until it restores. And there would be diseases that would not afflict the Israelites forever, and they would be able to enter back in. So if you're a priest, you have multiple jobs as a priest from the tribe of Levi. You have to teach the law of Moses. You have to mediate sacrifices, which means you're involved in all of the blood and the meat. And it's a very participatory set of actions. It is messy and it's very bloody. Part of what your task includes as well is looking at people's skin conditions. They come to you and they say, this looks raw, or this is oozing, or this is discolored. And you have to go by certain rituals or procedures to confirm that they're unclean. And so they're part of your one commentator said it's as if a priest was not as much a physician as he was a health inspector. Now that might be a good analogy here, that in among the roles of the priest was a kind of general overall health inspection. And if your skin, if your outward condition was concerning to the priest, it might result in the pronouncement of you being unclean. Not only did we see that skin is something that could be infected, think about the clothing you wear. Leviticus 13 addressed not only your physical skin, but what you might call your second skin, your clothing, the clothing that's right on top of your skin. And that clothing could become contaminated. There could be some sort of deterioration or mold within the clothing. And that clothing had to be isolated and even burned if it could not be fixed or restored. Leviticus 13, then, was about your physical skin and your second skin, your garments, being infected with something. You would be unclean. What Leviticus 14 is doing is giving us a bright side to this whole thing. It's talking about people who are welcomed back into the camp of Israel. They get to gather around the tabernacle. They get to participate in the worship of Yahweh. Leviticus 14 is full of hope. Leviticus 14 is like the transition from death to life. So if you think about the spectrum here that we've looked at over our weeks, God is the God of life, and the farther away you would get from the tabernacle, it's like symbolizing the realm of death. And that means coming out of that unclean realm and entering back into the Israelite community and engaging in tabernacle worship, it's like you've been brought to life. You're passing from death to life symbolically by that ritual and ceremonial confirmation, okay? So that's the spectrum we've kept in mind. For our outline, I want us to think about two big parts. The very last Roman numeral 3, is just a summary. The two big parts to the passage are about what happens when someone's healed of the disease. That's full of hope. And then, curveball, verses 33 to 53, what happens if your house gets mold? There is an issue of uncleanness that could be a part of your skin, a part of your clothing, or a part of your house. So that's what Leviticus 13 and 14 are addressing, this big idea of being rendered unclean, okay? So let's see the full of hope chapter as death to life is a transition, the Israelites approaching God, and then we'll think together, how should we as New Covenant Christians read this and find hope in these ancient ceremonies? So in verses 1 and following, we're going to see the first week outside the camp. It tells us in verse 1 through 3, the Lord said to Moses, "This shall be the law of the leprous person, or the person with the skin disease, for the day of his cleansing. He shall be brought to the priest, and the priest shall go out of the camp, and the priest shall look. Then if the case of leprous disease is healed in the leprous person," and then it tells us the priest shall command several things. But in these opening verses, what we need to note is that in this tabernacle area, the priest is going to leave the vicinity. Just because you're healed doesn't mean you show up in the tent of meeting and you scare the priest behind the bronze altar. Hey, you know, Eliezer, he's like, "What are you doing here?" You actually couldn't approach until you were confirmed clean by the priest. This is a meeting halfway. They're going to come out from whatever far vicinity they are, and the priests are going to leave the tabernacle, and they're going to meet one another so that a confirmation can take place. And if it seems to the priest that when he looks that the disease is healed, well, it tells us in verses 4 and following what has to happen. The priest shall command them to take for him who is to be cleansed two live clean birds and cedar wood and scarlet yarn and hyssop. Okay, so here's a picture for you. Here are the two clean birds. One wasn't alive very long. We'll explain that in just a second. And then some wood. You see, you can't see the scarlet cord very well, or the thread, and then this branch of hyssop. These are the requirements of what you are to have. And it says in verse 4, two live birds, cedar wood, scarlet yarn, and hyssop. One of these birds is not going to live very long. So these two birds, one of them is going to die, and this is part of a ceremony. And it all represents what's happening with your cleansing. And then cedarwood, scarlet yarn, and hyssop. This is probably woven or tied together in some way. I don't have a picture of it being tied together, but just imagine the wood and the branch of hyssop on it tied with the yarn. Okay, so you've got this thread binding on the wood, the set of branches. That's the instrument that's being constructed here. The last time we saw something about hyssop in the Old Testament, it was the night of the Passover. They would have slain the Passover lamb, taken hyssop branches, dipped it into the wood, and painted, right, the sides of their doorways and the top with that sacrificial blood so that the 10th plague would pass over the people. Well, these branches are going to be important with dipping and sprinkling in just a moment. So these are the items, okay? You've got two birds, you've got wood, you've got scarlet yarn and hyssop. In verse 5, the priest shall command them to kill one of the birds. That's why one of them's upside down on the screen. Kill one of the birds in an earthenware vessel over fresh water. Now, they need blood, but here's the problem. Birds don't have a lot of blood. It's not like you're dealing with a livestock animal. It's not like you're dealing with a herd or a flock animal. Birds don't have a lot of blood, and so one of the things that will increase the amount of blood is by squeezing blood from the bird into water. So over live water, the bird is killed over that so that the blood and water will mix and it makes more to sprinkle. Does that make sense? The water is for the practical purpose of having more to sprinkle. And then after you've killed that one bird, okay, there's one bird left. Am I next? No, he's not next. In verse 6, this is odd though, the live bird and the cedarwood scarlet yarn hyssop construction are dipped into the blood of the bird that was killed. So you've got the water in an earthen vessel. A bird has been killed, and that water is now bloody water. The live bird is dipped in it, and your branch yarned around this piece of wood is dipped in it, so that then you are going to let a bird leave that's got the blood of a dead bird on it. Does that make sense? You got a live bird flying away, and he's been dipped in this. It says in verse 6, he shall take the live bird and the cedar wood, the scarlet yarn and hyssop, dip them, and the live bird in the blood of the bird that was killed over the fresh water. And in verse 7, he shall sprinkle it 7 times on him who is cleansed. Here you are. You're the one whose skin has been restored. You know what happens to you next? That hyssop thing gets flicked at you, and that bloody water is going all over you. You say once? Nope. 7 times in verse 7. 7 times, 1, 2, 3, and then you're pronounced clean, and the living bird gets to go into the open field. In some way, what happened to you is represented by that living bird. It's like your defilement was absorbed by that bird, and it takes it away. That's the picture there. So that the bird leaving the vicinity is something that's now you're confirmed clean and can be brought near, okay? That's the picture. This is an odd ceremony, right? Killing one bird, dipping the other bird in that, and the branch and the hyssop. I like weird parts of the Bible, though. This is one of them. And then in verse 8, he who is to be cleansed shall wash his clothes. After all, you've got bloody water all over you. You got to wash your clothes, shave off all your hair, and bathe yourself in water, and he shall be clean. And then after that, he may come into the camp, but live outside his tent 7 days. So here's the catch. So you've got this tabernacle that you're approaching, right? All the encamped Israelites are around it in their individual tents. And in a way, you're brought to your house, but not inside yet. Not inside yet. You can't go into the tabernacle yet, and you can't go into your own house yet. You're just in the camp of the Israelites. You've got to be outside your house. You've got to be outside your house for the next week. You've got to be outside. So you're in the camp, but not fully restored yet. This is a process, and you can't cheat the process. In verse 9, on the 7th day, again, because there would be hair growth over those days, you've got to shave everything again. And look how thorough this is in verse 9. Shave off all his hair from his head, his beard, and his eyebrows, all right? This is, you look like you've just been born, okay? This is, and I think that's the idea of the picture. You don't look like a matured person who over these years has had hair come to their face and head. You look like you are brand new. And you have to bathe yourself in verse 8, and he shall be clean. In verse 9, he shall shave off all of his hair, wash his clothes and bathe, and he shall be clean. What are you doing after your week inside the camp? You are engaging in animal sacrifice. So this week has passed, and you're ready to be restored to tabernacle worship. And in verse 10, on the 8th day, and that was significant because that was when circumcision took place in Genesis 17, but on the 8th day, this is a different ritual. You shall take a number of animals. Here are the animals. 2 lambs without blemish, a ewe lamb, a year old without blemish, and then a grain offering. These are for 4 sacrifices, 3 animals and some flour. You also have a log of oil at the very end in verse 10. You'll see why the oil matters in just a minute. So you've got 4 kinds of sacrifices, 3 animals and some grain that are going to be those 4. And then you've got a log of oil. All of this In verse 11, the priest who cleanses him shall set the man who's to be cleansed and these things before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Now, we don't know how long you've been outside the camp. We don't know how long that skin disease was there. It could have been days, weeks, months, or years. But now, for the first time, since you're pronounced clean by the priest, you are coming to the tabernacle. And all of your sacrifices are going to be offered right there at what's called the bronze altar. Let's get a close-up. There it is. There is a close-up. At the bronze altar, these priests are going to offer these sacrifices on your behalf. And this is a big deal. This is celebratory. This is hope-giving. This is you coming back into life and restoration. You've wanted this day. You've longed for this day. Didn't matter what other obligations you might have had. That's the priority right there, friend. You want to be restored to the tabernacle worship. And in verse 12, the priest shall take one of the male lambs and offer it for a guilt offering. These are relying on the early offerings of Leviticus. That's where these names are coming from, the names of those five offerings. Offer it for a guilt offering along with a log of oil and wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. We've seen language like waving something as an offering before to dedicate something to God. If you in some way wave it, that motion indicates that this is for a divine and sacred purpose, and that's what these sacrifices will be for. And in verse 13, he shall kill the lamb in the place where they kill the sin offering. Now, he is probably the worshiper, because the worshiper in all the other offerings is the one doing the slaying of the animal. So you've got the lamb and you've got to slit its throat. But you're not reluctant to do this. You're being restored to worship. This is a big deal symbolically. So you kill the lamb. And in verse 13, this is at the place where they kill the sin offering and the burnt offerings as well, which means right there at the bronze altar. The lamb is alive when you bring it, and you slit its throat. And tells us in verse 13, for the guilt offering, like the sin offering, belongs to the priest, it is most holy. That means that the priests get to eat meat from this particular offering. Not all of it would be burned up on the altar. They would get to have some food, which is good, leftovers, lamb. And in verse 14, the priest shall take some of the blood of the guilt offering, and the priest shall put it on the lobe of the right ear of him who is to be cleansed, and on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. Now, those areas should sound eerily familiar, maybe not eerily, but it should sound remarkably familiar from the ordination of the priests earlier on. And that's because the priests were to be engaging in sacrificial worship, and they were set apart by having blood applied to their earlobe, to their thumb, and to their big toe. These were representative areas, right? It's like you had it on your elbow as well, or on the back of your neck. These were specifically chosen places because the ear represents hearing the word of God, the hand represented by the thumb, represents the doing of the sacrificial work, and the big toe on your foot represents that wherever you go in the courtyard, you go in the presence of God as a priest. And it's giving you a whole body consecration or setting apart. Well, these healed people, their skin disease is no more, they're being brought in and they're being restored to tabernacle worship. And so it's as if they are partaking once more in the identity of Israel as a kingdom of priests. They are being brought in, and they're going to have it applied to their earlobe, their thumb, and big toe. And that's what verse 14 gives us. That's going to happen again. They've already had hyssop branches, dashing blood on them. That's already happened. And then they wash their clothes, and now they're getting blood applied to their ear, hand, and feet. In verse 15, then the priest shall take some of the log of oil and pour it into the palm of his own left hand. So I want us to picture this. He's got oil, and he's pouring it into the palm of his hand, and then he's got his right finger. He dips it in his left hand, and he begins to sprinkle some of the oil with his finger seven times before the Lord. And this might be on the altar itself, which represents coming to God through sacrifice. That's what it may mean to sprinkle it before the Lord. But then in verse 17, some of the oil that remains, the priest shall put that on the right ear of him who's to be cleansed, and on his right thumb, and on the big toe of his right foot. Okay, this is part of the ceremony. You've come to be restored to sacrificial worship, and now you've got blood on your ear and oil. Blood on your right thumb and oil. Blood on your right big toe and oil. And it says in verse 17, this is all on top of the blood of the guilt offering that you've given. In verse 18, the rest of the oil that's in the priest's hand, he shall put on the head of him who is to be cleansed. So he's looking back at his left hand. Okay, still got oil there. Well, that's just going right on the guy's head. Okay, right on his head. Might have been a little, it might have been a lot. But you are being set apart once more to worship at the tabernacle. And that's what all of these works of worship do. Aren't you glad we're not engaged in this kind of ceremonial stuff? This seems so bizarre, right? We don't do any of this. We're welcomed in the presence of God through Christ, and we don't need anything on our earlobes or oil upon our big toes. Very, very odd. But then in verse 19, the priest shall offer the sin offering to make atonement for him who's to be cleansed, and afterward kill the burnt offering. Remember, there were three animals earlier, and a guilt, sin, and burnt offerings have all been offered. And in verse 20, the priest shall offer the burnt offering and grain offering. That's the flour. So everything that they've brought, the two live birds, the hyssop branch, the yarn and the wood, all of that's been used, as well as the three animals, as well as the grain. All of that is part of the ceremony. It is a complex procedure. It's not like you're just bringing one animal. You've got a lot of stuff that's all playing a very specific part in a very specific order. And then in verse 20, the priest shall offer the burnt offering and grain offering on the altar. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him, and he shall be clean. This means you are now restored for sacrificial worship. You can gather with the people of God, receive the blessing of the priest. You can pray and sing and bring your offerings of thanksgiving and peace and all the rest. You are a functioning worshiper, ritually speaking. You are among the clean, and that is a wonderful thing to celebrate. But here's the catch. What if you're poor? You can't necessarily afford all the different animals required. It's not a small amount of animals. If you have a limited flock, that livestock would be important for your family for a long time. And if all of a sudden they were saying, I need this animal and this animal and this animal, you might start sweating bullets thinking, I don't know if we could just give all of that. There are concessions made for the poor in the Levitical offerings. Here's one of them. Look in verse 21. But if he's poor and cannot afford so much, then he shall take one male lamb for the guilt offering. That's non-negotiable. To be waved and to make atonement for him. And the flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, a log of oil. But remember the lamb and the young ewe lamb earlier in verse 22? They will be replaced by two turtle doves or two pigeons, whichever he can't afford. Because see, we got to get this clear in our minds always with these sacrifices. There was nothing magical about the lamb, the ox, the bird. None of that, like, there was nothing about that animal. It was symbolic. It was the fact that the offer is coming with their heart dedicated to God, to worship him, longing to be out of the realm of the unclean and the dead, among the life and holiness of God and his people. And so if they couldn't afford to give all of the flock animals, that's okay. The Lord wants them. The Lord wants them. And he says, look, if you bring two turtle doves, we'll consider it done. That's all it would take. And so this is a concession so that no matter who you are in Israel, no matter what your financial standing, you will not be excluded from the worship of God by the kinds of animals you would have had to sacrifice. They will make concessions for you. This means in verse 23, on the eighth day, he shall bring them for his cleansing to the priest, to the entrance of the tent. Now notice the parallel procedure. If you're the poor, notice what's still the same. In verse 24, the priest shall take the lamb of the guilt offering and the log of oil, wave them as a wave offering. That was done earlier. In verse 25, he shall kill the lamb of the guilt offering. That was part of that earlier procedure announced. The priest shall take blood and put it on the lobe of his right ear, the thumb of his right hand, the big toe of his right foot. There needed to be blood, and the blood of this lamb is applied to both the rich and the poor of the Israelites. And then in verse 26, the priest shall take some of the oil into the palm of his own left hand and sprinkle with his right finger some seven times before the Lord. And then the priest shall take that oil in his hand and put it on the right ear of him who's to be cleansed, his thumb of his right hand, big toe. All of that we saw earlier. This is just saying for the poor, here's an exception for the animal, two turtle doves, and the other procedures are exactly the same. You're treated as an equal among the Israelites. In verse 29, the rest of the oil that's in the priest's hand, he shall put it on the head of him who's to be cleansed to make atonement for him before the Lord. And he shall offer of the turtle doves or pigeons, which he can't afford in verse 30, one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, along with that grain offering of flour. The priest shall make atonement before the Lord for him who's being cleansed. This is the law for him in whom there is a leprous disease who cannot afford the offerings for his cleansing. So what we've seen then is someone who had a skin disease being restored. They were restored in two big stages, right? The first stage, they come into the Israelite camp for a week, but they can't go in their own tent. And then after that week, they have to reshave and rewash everything. And then they're brought to the entrance of the tabernacle where they're going to offer these offerings. And if they were poor, some turtle doves in place of some of the animals. But blood had to be shed. A live bird was going to be released. All of that stuff is going to be the same. Now, in verses 33 through 42, we're going to see what happens when a house has mold. It's more than just through verse 42, but this is the first part where an investigation takes place. Here's the shift. The attention in this text is on if you own the house and the priest you have to report it to. Now, I know that we know people who are familiar with having to deal with mold in their house. Something in their ceiling, something in their wall, something in their floor. And this can happen with vehicles. It just reminds us that in a fallen world, nothing lasts if not attended to. Things break down, mess up, contract stuff that you have to fix. And these verses are for the future land occupancy of Israel, where they're going to have homes and not just portable tents. So in verses 33 and following, it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'When you come into the land of Canaan, which I give you for a possession.'" Remember, they're still at Mount Sinai. They're still spending these months at Mount Sinai receiving the Levitical laws, and they're going in Numbers 10 to travel eventually towards Sinai. But this verse is very encouraging. It's saying, when you come, God is not reneging on the promise. It will happen. They will travel from here. Canaan will be theirs. I give it to you as a possession. And if I put a case of leprous disease in the house in the land of your possession, then he who owns the house shall come and tell the priest, "There seems to me to be some case of disease in my house." They're using the same word for what was on our skin, for what was on our garment, for what's in our walls. Same word. It's like your house catches leprosy. This is a weird way of thinking about it, but it's as if an infection is spreading in your house, just like it could on garments and just like it can on skin. It's the same language being applied. Think of it as my physical skin, it's my first skin, my garment, that's covering me, and my roof is covering all of that. It's like you're moving to levels of what covers you. Your skin, your garments, your house. All of that can represent something that's unclean if not dealt with, and alienation from the presence of the Lord at the tabernacle. Well, let's see what has to be done then. You have to go to the priest. He's not going to come as a house inspector. It's your turn. I'm on a rotation. Let me look at your walls. Instead, if you suspect something, there's a disease in my home, you have to go tell the priest. Now, there might be a part of us that thinks, well, why draw attention to it? You'd have to have something done to your house. Now, it might be a health issue, but I'm just saying the priest isn't going to know unless somebody goes and tells the priest. But the thing to keep in mind is God knows. These laws are helping the people realize whatever we're doing before God. Let's not think we're going to hide anything from the priest. Let me wear my long sleeves so that the priest doesn't see my skin when I bring the sacrifice. Let me not invite any of the priests over for a meal. I don't want them to see the walls on my house and get suspicious. They're doing all they're doing before God. Don't hide it from the priest. I mean, the idea is if you suspect something in your wall, you should go to them. And in verse 36, the priest shall command that they empty the house before the priest goes to examine the disease, lest all that's in the house be declared unclean. So you got all your belongings. They're now in your yard. Okay? Your house is empty. This is not convenient. This is terribly inconvenient. Okay? But these laws are not for the sake of your convenience. It requires dedication and cost. And so afterward, the priest shall go in. He's going around, and he shall examine the disease. Here's an example here. This is a blown up, this is a close up of a corner of a house, and there's infection in the wall. We might say, here's a wall with leprosy, all right? Just to use the language of Leviticus 14. That's what we might imagine. And if you had the stones and plaster used in the ancient world, and you come in there, and the priest says, something's not right. You're right. This is some kind of infection. It's like your walls caught leprosy. He shall examine the disease in verse 37. And if the disease is in the walls of the house with greenish or reddish spots, and if it appears deeper than the surface, the priest shall go out of the house to the door and shut up the house 7 days. I don't know where you're staying, I don't know where your stuff goes, but you're not going back in. All I know is you're putting up yellow tape around, and no, this is cautionary moment here. You're not going in. That house is quarantined for 7 days. And then verse 39, and the priest shall come again on the seventh day and look. And if the disease has spread in the walls of the house, then the priest shall command that they take out the stones, and which is the disease, and throw them into an unclean place outside the city. Maybe we can isolate that infected area, right? Now, we think about this kind of construction with equipment and precise tools. Even today in 2019, when houses have this kind of issue, you go in and you take the special tools, you're able to isolate where mold or mildew would be, you're able to do work in walls or ceilings. In other words, you don't have to destroy the whole property. There are ways of isolating this. So in verse 41, he shall have the inside of the house scraped all around. And the plaster that they scrape off, they shall pour out in an unclean place outside the city. So if these things represent what's unclean, you know where it goes? Outside the camp. Why would it go inside the camp? Only what's clean is allowed there. Then they shall take other stones in verse 42 and put them in the place of those stones and take other plaster and plaster the house. It's like you're doing some home improvement, right? You're having to remove a situation. You're having to replace what's there. But, there's always a but. In verse 43, if the disease breaks out again in the house, after he's taken out the stones and scraped the house and plastered it, the priest shall go and look. And if the disease has spread in the house, it's a persistent leprous disease in the house, it's unclean. He shall. In verse 45, break down the house. Its stones and timber and all the plaster of the house and carry them all outside the city to an unclean place. So the place where you lived, it gets torn down piece by piece, and then piece by piece, it gets taken out of the camp. There goes your house. Moreover, in verse 46, whoever enters the house while it's shut up shall be unclean until the evening. Whoever sleeps in the house shall wash his clothes. Whoever eats in that house shall wash his clothes. You don't want to have a ritual contamination. So that's about a persistent case. But in verse 48, if the priest comes and looks and the disease hasn't spread, this means they've replaced stones, they've replastered stuff. If on further examination, time passes and it doesn't spread, doesn't return, then in verse 48, the priest shall pronounce the house clean. It's ideal for your skin to be pronounced clean, your garment to be pronounced clean, and your house to be pronounced clean. It all represents coverings. Coverings of your bones, then of your body, and then of your head with a roof. And then in verse 49, or verse 48, it says at the end, for the disease is healed. And in verse 49, for the cleansing of the house, he shall take, two small birds, cedar wood, scarlet yarn, and hyssop. I wonder what's coming now. I bet one of those birds is going to die. Yep, in verse 50, he shall kill one of the birds in an earthen well vessel over the fresh water. So you see a similarity here, right? The way you treated restoring yourself to the position of being clean and with tabernacle worship is how you acknowledge the confirmation of cleanness for your house. And then in verse 51, you shall take the cedar wood, the hyssop, and the scarlet yarn. This means the branch is probably bound with that string to the wooden stick, right? And so we're back to this here. And the bird and the branch are all dipped in that, sprinkled the house seven times. You don't have to be sprinkled there. It was your house that was unclean. And in verse 52, he shall cleanse the house with the blood of the bird and with the fresh water and with the live bird and with the cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet yarn. He shall let the live bird go out of the city and into the open country. So he shall make atonement for the house and it shall be clean. This is representing the fact that there was uncleanness that's not there anymore. And the way to communicate that symbolically is to take a bird, dip it in blood, and send it away flying. It's as if that uncleanness has departed from this place, either from your body, from your garment, or from your house. What we see in verses 54 to 57 is the summary of the topics that we've looked at. I think this is really a summary for all of chapter 13 and 14, not just for tonight. This is the law for any case of leprous disease, for an itch, for leprous disease in a garment, or in a house. So the itching and the garments, those skin and clothing issues, that was chapter 13. But the house, well, that's chapter 14. Verse 56 says, for a swelling, an eruption, or a spot, that's all chapter 13. To show when it's unclean, when it's clean. This is the law for leprous disease. That leaves us reminded about how extraordinary the ministry of Jesus was. When you think about the uncleanness on skin, garments, or homes, I want you to remember some of what we covered last week. In the ministry of Jesus, he healed people of diseases, and part of what he healed were skin diseases. The miracles of Jesus are more powerfully appreciated when we have the background of Leviticus to remind us of some things. First of all, in Matthew 8, a leper comes up to Jesus, and that's all wrong starting out. That leper should have remained distant. He should have shouted, unclean, unclean. And then, surprise, surprise, he says, if you will, you can make me clean. And Jesus must not be like any other priest they've ever met, because priests didn't heal people. But Jesus does. And this person with a skin disease, this leper, as the text says, comes to Jesus, and Jesus says, I will be clean. And just as God said, let there be light, and there was light, Jesus says, I will and be clean, and the man is immediately healed. That story is also in Mark's gospel, also in Luke's gospel. There were also 10 lepers in Luke 17 that are healed. They all come up to Jesus. In fact, the story that I alluded to at first in Matthew 8, Jesus touches the leper. Contact with uncleanness. But Jesus is not defiled. He is the source of all life and purity, the God of holiness and life, the very tabernacle among them. He is the glory of God in their midst, veiled in the flesh of his incarnation. Jesus is there, truly God and truly man. And they're not exiled outside the camp with Jesus. When they're coming up to Jesus, they're coming to the true and greater tabernacle. John says the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Whoa, this is a big deal in the ministry of Jesus. They're right there coming to the one who is the fulfillment of the bronze altar and the water basin and the Ark of the Covenant and the place of cleansing. He is this. He's the tabernacle. Now, we also see a few other lines in Matthew and Luke's Gospels that I didn't mention last week that I want to mention tonight. In Matthew 8:4, when Jesus heals that one leper, he says, go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded. What is he talking about there? Why would he be going to a priest for the priest to confirm that he's clean? What is he going to be offering? The appropriate sacrifice. Why would Jesus command him to do that? Because that's what Leviticus 14 says to do. Jesus is directing them to obey the law. And then when he goes and heals in Luke 17, the 10 lepers, they come up to Jesus, they're healed. And Jesus says to them in Luke 17, 14, go and show yourselves to the priests, because they've been living as the unclean in the realm of the unclean. But Jesus has restored them. And you know what Leviticus 14 says? You need to have a conversation with a priest now. They need to be able to look at you and confirm your cleanness. And so Jesus is not telling them to violate the law. He's making them clean and telling them to now obey the law. He himself is the one who would not abolish the law by his own words. In Matthew 5:17, he's come to fulfill the law and the prophets. Now, prior to the work of Jesus on the cross, these very strange ceremonial practices were in vogue. Now, we don't deal with hyssop branches, two birds where one of them dies and the other's dipped in its blood. We're not dealing with any lambs and we're not dealing with this kind of set of procedures. It does feel foreign to us. I have never studied Leviticus 14 in depth. I was studying for this stuff in the previous days, and I was just blown away by the remarkable detail, the repetition of procedure, and just how unfamiliar this altogether is for New Covenant Christians, where we don't approach God with anything like this. It's very different. We're reminded that the ceremonial laws were always meant to be temporary under the law of Moses, the covenant with Israel made at Mount Sinai. When Jesus purchases a new covenant through his body and blood, when he fulfills the sacrificial system through his death, when he takes the defilement of sinners upon himself, the purpose of these ceremonial laws is complete. So we're not more spiritual if we try to incorporate this kind of thing in our discipleship or in some way a pattern in our lives. That's nonsense. That's not what we are meant to see. We're meant to see that these things are being kept and fulfilled in Christ Jesus, who kept the law in our place. These were symbols and signposts of a deeper defilement. They were a deeper defilement. And the deaths of these animals were representing that in my defilement, I don't deserve to come into the presence of God. My sin and its effects has alienated me from God. I deserve to die. but by animal blood being shed and by people being brought near to God through sacrifice, all of that's preparing for the cross. All of that's preparing for the cross. In Isaiah 53, the future deliverer is depicted as a servant who would suffer. In Isaiah 53, 4, the suffering servant, he says, has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And yet we esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our sins, our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. So the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. You, that live bird that flew away covered in blood, that's picturing that we need something to take away our defilement. So John the Baptist says, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." You want a sacrifice who's going to deal with our defilement in a way that's going to complete all of these ceremonies and all of, then you need to look to Jesus. The laws in Leviticus are signposts pointing us to the deep work of cleansing from sin that the suffering servant would accomplish, who is Jesus. He declared from the cross, "It is finished," and we are not separated from him outside the camp. You know what we have in Christ? Union with Christ by faith that never changes. Union with Christ. We are never sent by him away from his presence outside the camp. We are forever in union with Christ. Through faith, we have union with Christ, and his standing is imputed to me because my sins were counted to him. Salvation in Christ means I will never be alienated from Christ. I have a permanent standing and security because of the work of Jesus Christ on my behalf on the cross. The Levitical laws should make us long, though, for things to be made new. When we think of clothing, we think of skin diseases, we think of other ailments, we think of homes that break down, we live in a world full of affliction. Things are not right. But Leviticus 13 and 14 and other parts of the Bible, they keep us longing for that day when everything's going to be made new. When the effects of sin and corruption in this world will not continue to perpetuate, God's blessing will one day fill the earth as the waters cover the sea. And then his glory will be shared by his people who have been raised to resurrection life. And they will be glorified in him. And they will exalt him forever. The Bible's healings point to that day. In this world right now, our bodies wear down, our clothes wear out, and our homes fall apart. We know this to be true. It is all too real and before our eyes. We see that we are outwardly wasting away. But Jesus is going to return, and he's going to vanquish the wicked, and he's going to raise the saints to immortal bodily life, and we will dwell with God. And we will dwell with God in a way that will never result in uncleanness or exile. Jesus says, "Let not your hearts be troubled." Talk about a place that's never going to break down or become unclean or need to be emptied out so that the priest could inspect it. Listen to the rooms prepared for us. "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may also be." That's a great hope.